College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
And welcome to the College Football Podcast with David Pollock. I'm your host, Kevin Negandhi. Ahead, Florida Gator head coach Dan Mullen will join us, as well as Paul Feinbaum. We hope everybody listening is healthy and safe during these uncertain times. And there are plenty of topics to discuss, David, when it comes to college football making the news. And the time we're taping this podcast, it's just a couple of hours before Iowa's Kirk Ferentz has a scheduled news conference with three other players. And there are many rumors on what will be discussed as this news conference. But here's what we know. A handful of past players who are African-American have spoken out on the culture of walking on eggshells there with black players being treated unfairly. And longtime strength coach Chris Doyle had been put on administrative leave pending a review after former players talked about negative experiences while at Iowa under Doyle's supervision. Doyle issued a statement denying ever crossing the line when it comes to an unethical behavior or any type of bias upon race here. David, from everything we've gathered out there, seeing the responses from the players, seeing how Iowa has changed certain things where players now can tweet and voice their opinions on social media, what's your first reaction to what's going on here?
Well, it's a different world we're about to be living in. And I think coaches are going to realize this fast. Coaches back in the day used to be able to intimidate. Coaches back in the day used to be able to get away. I mean, this isn't just about like how you speak to people. Physically, coaches used to be able to beat the crud out of people. I mean, remember that. Like, they used to grab helmets, and you've seen coach – like, back – everybody who played college football in my era, in high school football, in the era before ours, like, you are going to have physical altercations with your coaches. Like, that was going to happen. People have access to – I think players are starting to realize they have power. They have the ability to say – this is wrong and not feel ostracized or not feel like the coaches are going to be able to silence them anymore. So I think it's going to be interesting. We've talked about how difficult it is to navigate in a world with social media for coaches and trying to get players and keep them off there just from the standpoint of them being told how good they are, how bad they are, positive and negative. Now you're talking about a whole nother box that's been opened and a whole nother way that they're going to have to think about it. If coaches thought their jobs were hard, they're now going to have to come up with more ways to think outside the box and to make sure that they watch what they say. And I don't think anybody this is necessarily going to think it's a bad thing. I think it can be 100% a good thing. I don't think you have to be a butthole to get the max out of your players. I don't think that's the case. I think you've seen that with several coaches that it's kind of changed that dynamic. So I think it's a different world we're living in, where players are going to have more power and more freedom. They're going to feel like they have a safety net and more freedom to use that power.
What's it say though, David, that it's taken this long for player empowerment at many schools, not just Iowa, at a variety of different places? You know, you saw it at Florida State last week. These guys are realizing they have a voice and there is no union, right? That's the difference is college football, right? That they don't have a union like the NFL or the NBA or right now what we're seeing with Major League Baseball or the NHL. At the same time, though, they're producing so much money for universities. What's it say that they are now coming together and realizing that they have a voice?
Well, it's understanding the situation, and this is the time now to be able to understand that they can take advantage of it too. Listen, I didn't know any better, Kevin. I'll be the first to admit I was in college. I graduated college 15 years ago, and I didn't know I could say something against my coach, nor would I ever dream about it. But as time goes on, we're all growing up different. We're having different experiences, and we're going to be able to say and do different things. And I think they're understanding that. I never had that as an option. So I think that you're seeing that now, and you'll see players take advantage of it. And by the way, they should take advantage of it. Wouldn't you? I mean, everybody would. So take advantage of it. Make sure that they're getting the things that they want to get met, and listen, they're about to be able to take advantage of their likeness. We were not able to do that. They're about to be able to make money off of their likeness, which a lot of players in the past would have been very happy to do, because you make money off your likeness, it makes your college experience a lot better. A lot of us, I mean, I didn't go out to eat a lot in college. I didn't have the money to do that. So everything is definitely changing fast.
All right. You mentioned changing. Another huge story this week, surrounds Clemson. You know, Dabo Swinney releasing a 14-minute video statement earlier this week after facing criticism for not firing assistant Danny Pierman. Now, Pierman used a racial slur during practice in 2017. Dabo also wore a Football Matters t-shirt while posing for a photo last Saturday during the height of the Black Lives Matters protest. And now, let's clear this up. The Football Matters, the Football Matters theme, that shirt, that message.
It's been around for months.
That came out in 2014.
Yeah,
so the timing of it, though, the awareness of what was going on, that became a big topic. Christian Wilkins, yep. his grandfather was killed by police in what was deemed a mistake shooting in 2011. He played for Dabo, and he was a critical part of that Tiger team the last few years. He spoke out defending Dabo. DeAndre Hopkins made sure to say that Dabo's not a racist. Trevor Lawrence, he's spoken out the last couple of days defending Dabo, including a bunch of current players. What are your thoughts on how Dabo's handled the last 2 weeks?
Well, first of all, Football Matters. I mean, I think we all have shirts in our closet that have been in there for a while that you just put on, you know, and I don't necessarily – I do. Okay, I'll speak for myself. I got tons of crap in my closet. I don't even know what I'm wearing an Oregon shirt right now. Okay. Like I don't care. I'm going to put on whatever shirt I have. Is it the best situational awareness from Dabo? Probably not. Right. Like it could have been, you probably could have, if you would have thought about it, you probably would have changed your outfit and that wouldn't have happened. But listen, I'm not concerned the slightest bit about Dabo being a racist. I think he's proved what he is. I think he's proved who he is. I think his actions have spoken loud over the last several years as a coach and the way he handles his players. And by the way, I would expect every single player. Here's the thing that's going to be interesting to me about this. Kevin, there's people at every institution. When I was at the University of Georgia, I could pick out 10 to 15 to 20 players who were very unhappy with the situation because they didn't play as much as they wanted to. They didn't think they got a fair shake and they thought they were mistreated, blah, blah, blah. Like all those kids now and all those adults now are going to have an opportunity to speak out and say they were treated unfairly. They didn't get an opportunity. I think it's going to be very interesting with this kind of stuff because you're going to have an opportunity to have a history of the past, of what happened in the past. And I think we're going to hear a ton of stories, Kevin, and we're going to have a ton of people coming out right now because people right now definitely feel like this is the time to do it. This is the time where I can say something because everybody's listening. The world has stopped. You know, the sports has stopped. It's the pandemic stopped the world. And, you know, now there's so much going on where I can say something and people are more inclined to listen.
The one thing that stood out, which you just said, is the world is listening, right? And
yep.
we just hope that whatever is being said through a filter of not personal vendetta, but the reality of what the experience has been like individually when many of these players are just looking for equality, right? And that is my fear. You brought up something that is my fear. You don't want it to be a personal vendetta where you get the chance to say, oh, well, I'm not playing enough, I'm going to speak out.
It's got to happen, Kevin. It's just the world we live in. Like it's going to people don't have a clue. Listen to me. When I was in college, I didn't have a clue about the world and how. I remember vividly situations now in college that the way my coach would talk to me, and it would piss me off so bad, and I would be so angry and so upset, and it would motivate me to go play harder. That's all my coach was trying to do. I didn't know it at the time. He was just ticking me off. You know, like the coaches use different things and different methods, and you don't understand it all when you're 17, 18, 19 years old. And sometimes, and by the way, sometimes some of those things can be negative as you get older. But also, I know another thing too, as time goes on, things get more blurry for me. I'm getting older. Like I don't remember things as well as I used to remember them. So I think we're going to get some of that for sure, you know, and more so over the next couple months.
Yeah, and it's not just current players too. We're seeing star players returning back and voicing their opinion. You know, earlier this week, you know, former Clemson players DeAndre Hopkins and Deshaun Watson and others, they petitioned the university to remove the name of John C. Calhoun from the school's honors college, with Hopkins noting that, hey, when he's introduced on Sunday Night Football, he doesn't say I'm from Clemson because the slave owner's influence is the reason why at the university. And today, the Board of Trustees at Clemson, they approved changing the name of the university's honors college to now the Clemson University Honors College. And that's effective immediately. And that to me is the impact of change when many of these guys, they see after they graduate, they get a little bit older and they understand the power that they have, right?
Yep.
And speaking out on issues that matter, right? And Hopkins and Watson right now.
Well, Kevin, this is also the younger generation. They're way more inclined to speak their mind anyways. I mean, this is a generation that is media savvy, is technologically savvy, is social media savvy as it gets. And here's the thing I love about camera phones and technology. It catches crap. Like I love technology. I love the fact that people have filmed things in bars that were wrong that are seen. I love people that are filming things all across the country that, like, I hate some of the technology that comes with it, but these kids have grown up, and all these guys, think about the young stars in the NFL with Deshaun Watson and Mahomes and Nuke Hopkins and all these guys that are speaking out. This is a generation that is okay with speaking out. A lot of the generations in the past, including the one I grew up in, you didn't speak out against your coach. You just didn't do that. Like that, this generation is going to be a generation that's going to say, we're going to speak our mind. If something's wrong, we're going to say it. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah. And excellent point on the cell phones with the cameras, because we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Cop,
I guarantee it.
Like there are a lot of great cops out there. And I feel bad for a lot of great cops that are having to go through a lot of situations that put their lives on the line every day for us. I feel bad that they have to deal with a lot of the negative stuff, but cop cans are accountability. Everybody in this world, I need accountability. Everybody needs forms of accountability. Because guess what, Kevin? There are good people in this world, and there are people in this world that are going to do bad things. Like, and you can find every color of every. You can find every kind of every. There, you can find everything in all of that, by the way. So the more accountability we have with that kind of stuff, I think has been a good thing, because people can see when somebody's doing something wrong, and now it's on display for the whole world.
Excellent point. I agree with you on all fronts. And thankfully, this generation of kids that have the cell phones are recording everything we see. So we have documentation, and it's not just our word against your word. It's our word. Look at this video. Look at the truth that's showing and playing out compared to, you know, whatever story that is being made up. And that's where we're at right now in society. And unfortunately, people are, we've always grown up in a world where people are watching, right? But now more than ever, people are recording while watching.
Nope. No doubt.
All right, David, quick story here. I was born in Philadelphia. I like to talk about that a lot, but I grew up actually in a town. Well, I grew up in a town called Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. And while in college at Temple, as a 19-year-old, I tried to get some writing experience at the local paper. It was called the Evening Phoenix. And I had to do a college football preview.
This was 79 or 60?
No. This is back in like 1994. I had to do a college football preview for the local team just a few miles away in Collegeville called Your Sinus. And you know who they had to replace on that team? They had to replace a tight end named Dan Mullen. And here, two decades later, the Florida head coach joins us now on the College Football Podcast. Dan, it's great to have you here with us. These are uncertain times. And from the pandemic to questions about equality for the Black community, what has been your specific message to your players in this time?
Well, boy, we've been able to cover a lot with our players, right? Even though I do know that tight end you're talking about, he must have been really, I knew he was tough to replace on that or sign in team in 94. All Centennial Conference. With everything going on with our players, there's been a lot of time, that goes. And one of the hard things to me was, you know, you're doing all these virtual meetings with the players, and one of the hardest things, not being able to see people face to face, you know, that I think that's always tough. But, you know, one of the biggest messages that we've tried to give our guys, you know, during this whole time apart, during dealing, with all the virtual meetings and being separated from each other, is we can sit here and worry about what we can't control. Okay. And be upset that we're not having spring practice or worried about stuff that we can't control, or we can find a positive way to get better. You know, let's look at what we can control. Let's worry about what we can control. Let's find ways to get better. And that's really been the message, is try to stay as positive we can through all this and find ways to improve ourselves as a team. And you know what? I think, I'm really pleased with how our guys have handled all of this. I think we found ways to get better. Now our guys are able to come back on campus for voluntary workouts. I think most of our guys are in good shape. They found ways to work out. They found ways to get better at football. And I know our guys are chomping at the bit to get out there and get ready to play again.
Hey, Coach, you talked about, the virtual stuff, and I bet it's a new world, like learning a new language for all the stuff that you've had to do and had to go through. How do you talk about such big issues like race and inequality and all this stuff? Because I can remember being an 18-year-old kid, Dan, and having a lot of opinions, but I didn't know how to express it, man. Like, I didn't know how to get it out. I mean, I didn't know how to stand in front of people and in front of a whole room and get that kind of stuff out. Now you're used to it. You're used to dealing with reporters and talking, and you've got a comfort zone with that. How do you navigate that now in a world with Zoom and stuff like that?
Well, I think a lot of our guys, what we've tried to do is, we've had a lot of individual meetings with guys, and be able to talk and express themselves in that way. But we've done a lot in position groups, because I think one thing, instead of having guys say, get up in front of the entire team to talk right off the bat, hey, let's talk within our position groups. Because when you get in within the position group, there's already a great deal of comfort and camaraderie within that group, because you spend so much time together. And so I think it's an easier way to kind of start all different conversations for guys and to break out. And a lot of our coaches, fortunately, I mean, I will be honest, it's not something that is different for us in maybe the topics change at different times. But we spend a lot of times, I talk to our position coaches all the time. I said, make sure you're spending time on non-football things within your position meeting group so that guys are comfortable talking to each other, so that guys come together more, so that we can talk about anything within that group. And so we've been doing that for a long time. So within that group, there's a lot of comfort and ease to kind of start guys in to feeling comfortable at discussing things that are going on in the world.
Dan, what's your plan too? Because, obviously you're dealing with high emotions and people that are upset and young men from 18 to 22 trying to process things. But at the same time, we're in the middle of a pandemic. So how are you guys approaching this from an administrative point of view and a coaching staff when it comes to testing? And if you do have a positive test, what's the response?
Fortunately, we have not had one yet, but, and so we're working on that, with the test and trace policy that we're going to have in effect here to try to get back to normal for our guys. But there is, there's so much going on. I think the one thing is voluntary, our guys can come back and have voluntary workouts on campus. Well, the majority of our team is back here because they're ready to get life back to normal a little bit for themselves. So, one of the things I think we are really fortunate here, I think the university, our administration here at the university, has done a great job leading and putting things in place. And is really, we've seen, fortunately for us, and I hope it continues, minimal spread around campus, and around our athletics department. And, but I think also here in Florida, I think the governor has done an amazing job. And I think you see that, even the return to normalcy in Florida and for the size of the state that we have and for things that are going, they've done an amazing job with trying to limit it as much as possible. And I think you've seen, the numbers of the virus here in Florida are not as high as other places around the country, despite the massive population and everything that we have here. That there's just been great leadership all the way from the governor, the university administration, and for everybody and the guys in our team taking responsibility to do things the right way.
All right, Coach. Obviously, there's so much going on. Now let's talk about football. Like, let's talk about next season. And I'm sure it's something that you're wanting to talk about. And I love the fact that you came out, Coach, and you talked about, and people asked you, and you expect to be in the playoff discussion. You expect to be one of those teams. Like, who starts a season and be like, you know what? We don't want to be in that conversation. Like, yeah. I love the fact
could you imagine being on a team that just already expects to lose a bunch of games? We're going to lose a bunch of games this year. I think with everybody, I think, and one of the, I'll tell you what, one of the things that makes the Southeastern Conference different is I think there's about 14 different fan bases that expect their teams to be in that discussion this year. And, you know, maybe not every conference is like that, but down here there's 14 schools that every single school expects their team to be in that discussion.
Well, Dan, I can tell you in my household, it's only Florida Gators, as I married a Gator. And, you know, when I mentioned to her that you were going to be on the podcast with me today, she was like, darn right, what took you so long? I was like, okay, I appreciate that. Thanks. Thanks for your support. But to give you an idea.
She must be super smart, right? Because, we are the only school in America that each of the last two seasons is a top 10 public university in America and a top 10 football school. Only school in America that's both.
Wow.
So you outkicked your coverage a little.
Well, let me tell you, Dan, she won't listen to the podcast. She's told me that already. So I will save that nugget and bring it up to dinner and then look even smarter if we're in an argument, okay? I will put that in my back pocket for future use. But to give you an idea how much of a turnover is happening in the SEC, especially at the quarterback position, the conference's most accomplished and stats-leading quarterback is your guy, Kyle Trask. I mean, he went 8-2 as a starter. He deserves that Kentucky win when he came in. What did you learn about Trask last season? Because there was a lot of unknown for people on the outside, especially since he didn't have a lot of game experience back in high school or on the college level.
Well, you know what? It shows a lot about who he is as a person, his character, and his work ethic. You know, because you see in today's world, you know, a lot of these guys is, hey, if I'm not starting as a sophomore, I'm transferring. Or, you know, I mean, and I'm, you know, I hate that. And David knows this. You know, I mean, 20 years ago, that wasn't the case, you know, and, it's something that's, you know, and I shouldn't say and generalize it that much. It's not everywhere, but you know, there's a lot of guys that are, you know, they're trying to rush through their career instead of worrying about development. You know, and you look at Kyle's career path and, he's a guy that just, hey, I'm here to work. I'm going to be prepared for when my number's called. I'm always trying to get better. And all of a sudden, you know, his number's called. And there he is, ready to go. And all of a sudden, he gets that opportunity against Kentucky when we have an injury. Felipe Franks, he comes back and leads the comeback and leads us to a victory. You know, and then leads us to our, you know, our second straight top 10 finish and second straight New Year's Bowl victory. And you know what? It could have been really easy for him to pack it up and transfer. It could have been really easy for him to say, hey, I've been a backup. I'm just not going to prepare and continue to get better. You know, because human nature is like, hey, I keep working. I'm ready to play. I'm ready to play, but I'm not getting on the field. But, you know, it just shows really who he is as a person and the character that he has as a person, that he continued to improve himself, continued to get better, worried about that, worried about being prepared. And when his moment was there, he was ready to go seize on that moment. And I'm going to tell you, it is an unbelievable life lesson for people out there. You know, don't give up. Don't quit. Keep preparing. And all of a sudden, when you have an opportunity, you're ready to seize it and great things happen to you. And now he's a guy that nobody even knew his name to a guy now that is, like, as you said, really one of the top quarterbacks returning in not just the SEC, but really the country.
Yeah, and I'm also going to give you a ton of credit, Coach, because you always do a great job offensively getting your quarterback ready. What have you done this offseason? Maybe that's a little bit different, like study wise, because I know talking to a lot of these coaches, y'all got more time than y'all ever had. Like, y'all ain't used to being at home. Y'all ain't used to having a honey-do list. Y'all haven't been used to this much time off. Is there anything Dan Mullen's been studying or, you know, Zoom conference calls or just any kind of offense that you've been looking at to expand and do more?
Well, I think we've studied a bunch of stuff. We've researched ourselves, researched opponents. We've done some research and studies on people. But I'll be honest with you. You know, one of the things you have to be careful of that is getting too much. You know, yeah. I mean, there's so many plays to call and so little time to do them all. I mean, I could drop a 10,000 play playbook for you, you know, and we only get 900 some snaps in a season. And so that would mean, you know, I mean, you could, it's just so limitless if you want to go that far into it. And so one of the things you have to do is really keep yourself research, study, try to understand your team. I think one of the things that is going to be trickier for people this year, not having spring practice, is understanding what type of team you have. You have an idea, but you know what? We're a different team this year than we were last year. Players are different this year than they were last year. And you know, so how are we going to adjust our scheme to best suit all the strengths of all of our players? And, you know, you need to be out on the field to figure that out. So there'll be a little bit of a learning curve going into the season for some people. We want to always make sure we have enough flexibility to do it within our package to always highlight the strengths of our players. But you also don't want to go overboard and kind of overwhelm these guys. You know, I mean, we could go out there and run the wishbone. We could go run, you know, the single wing. We could put in some wing T stuff. We can run, you know, some spread option. We can run some spread pass. We could run some, you know, the pistol offense, get in the eye. You could, I mean, there's so much you could do, but you got to make sure it all fits for your team.
You mentioned making things fit. So how do you get Emory Jones involved in the offense more with Kyle under center?
Well, it'll be interesting. Kyle better work because Emory's out here trying to get his job. You know, Emory wants to be our starter this year. And, you know, and that's one of the things that I think when you talk about quarterback development, one, that, you know, how we set up our practice, how we train and develop our guys. I think we Brian Johnson does a great job of it. And we have a really good, program that does that, how we run the program to develop quarterbacks. But they get the opportunity to go compete. So, you know, I expect Emory, you know, I mean, he's, you know, you look at opportunities and I appreciate it because these guys learn from each other. And Emory got opportunities. We threw him in, we put him in games, different situations, and you look, he's played in a lot of big games and he's played at key moments. He doesn't just come up if we're up big or one of those. There is a pack there. He is in and he's ready to go. And I think he knows as that continues to grow, as he gains that experience, he's going to be prepared and ready for his moment. And we're going to be able to play more than one quarterback during the course of the season.
Coach, as you look at your team and like the pulse of your team, who are some guys like Pitts comes to mind, obviously, because he's a freak. I mean, he was fun to watch and you could use him in different ways. Who's some guys, even though you haven't had the offseason, who's some guys that we're going to get to know that'll be household names by the end of the season?
Boy, you know, that's going to be interesting. I think, you know, with some of our receivers graduating, you know, last year, I think when you look at that group of, you know, the veteran guys that are now the veteran guys of Jacob Copeland, Kadarius Toney, Trey Grimes, I think they're going to take some big steps forward for us, out there on the field. You know, Ventrell Miller, our inside linebacker now has become, you know, kind of a first year starter now to a veteran player. Sean Davis came back this year for his senior year at the safety position for us. You know, and you go back and watch the cut ups and really see him grow and improve. And I think really is one of the most underrated safeties in the league. I think Marco Wilson, who I know, you know, last year, you know, he was on the other side of CJ Henderson, and CJ Henderson got a lot of attention last year. And now he's a top 10 pick. And, you know, Marco's ready to kind of take that over. And I think Marco thinks he'll be a top, you know, we think he'll be a top 10 pick this year.
Well, you put out top 10 corners every year. So that's kind of normal, man. It's just kind of next one.
Right? We're DBU here, right? That'll talk to the face right there. Florida is the real DBU though. The original, right?
Well, you keep churning them out, and the recruiting's been fantastic. I mean, and there's also attrition. You guys have lost some players in the last couple of years, all very different circumstances. I want to get your thoughts on when it comes to recruiting and also the news that's going to be coming out later on today with, you know, you mentioned the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. He's scheduled to speak today. He's expected to sign a bill that would help Florida's college athletes make money from their name, likeness, image here. What are your thoughts on that process and how it's going to affect recruiting and what you guys are doing, as well as the landscape of college football?
Well, I think obviously it's going to have a major impact on college football when you get into the name, image, and likeness. And, you know, one of the things, and everyone says, okay, what's your opinion on it? Well, I'm not writing the laws and I'm not the decision maker. So my opinion's not as really I'm someone that's going to have to adjust to it and find the best way to make it work, for players. You know, and so it's just going to change I think it'll change the college motto. I think there'll be some unintended circumstances that are out there. And you know, that I think people look and say, here's some great benefits. I think there'll be some unintended circumstances that could be negative. As well with it. And so it's going to be really interesting to see over the next couple of years what direction all of this goes. And for the guys, because I think it will. I think it will change college athletics for the future.
Dan, before we let you go, I started the conversation about, you know, your time at your sinus as well as being a tight end. But and I think Paula could appreciate this question. I want to know what that number, the number 36 means to you.
Yeah. That's my number. So here's, I'm going to give you a share a quick story with you. So when I was a freshman in high school at Trinity High School in Manchester, New Hampshire, I went in and it was kind of funny. Like, you know, one of my good teammates, a really close friend of mine, at the original time, I think they put me at running back and him at quarterback. And after about the first week and a half, we flipped those two. I'm not a real dynamic running back, and he's pretty good. And I was pretty smart, could lead the team and make good decisions, get us into the right plays. I don't know that I was a real dynamic passer or anything, but I could get us going in the right direction. So we went in that year, and they hand out jerseys. And I got, as a freshman, I got a varsity jersey. And back then, it wasn't like you had six different uniform combinations. Okay. There was about, right? You know, you go back to the old days. There were about 50 to 60 varsity jerseys. There wasn't a 1 to 99 varsity jersey. You know, I mean, like, hey, yeah, you know, every 3 years you'd buy new varsity jerseys, right? And so the seniors would take them when they leave. So if anybody had one of those of the previous two graduating classes, those numbers were no longer in the program. We didn't have those in the equipment room anymore. So it came out, and I got number 36. And even though it's a quarterback, it's a little funky number. But you know what? I took so much pride in getting that varsity jersey. And I think people that play football, they know that. I got handed that 36, and I was never letting it go. So I was 36 as a quarterback all through high school. And I get to college, and I was a quarterback. And, you know, when I went to college as a quarterback, they gave me number 10. And that never really fit well with me. And, but after my freshman year, it was, hey, I had the opportunity to kind of be a backup quarterback or play tight end. And, you know, and I was one of those, I wanted to be on the field, do whatever it takes to help the team. So I said, listen, if you need me back at quarterback, I'll go back to quarterback, but I want to be on the field. So I'll go move to tight end because I want to play. I want to help the team do whatever I got to do and I can be out there playing. And, so immediately went and threw away that 10 jersey and took my 36 back since I was going back to tight end. So that's a special number to me right there.
Did I hear you took it from a punter too, the 36?
That's what it was. Yeah. I think he'll say it, but I thought it was a punter, like had number 36. I'm like, hey, you're number 10 now. My parents just bought 36 shirts. I'm like, well, that would be good. They'll be cheering for me during the game.
I'll give them something to cheer for. That's all right.
Hey, Dad, yeah, we do appreciate the thing.
It's special, right? Pollock, what were you? You were 49? Was that, am I right on that?
I was 47.
47. I was close. That was pretty good of me to even get it in the 40s.
That was close. I was 44 in high school, and then when I got to Georgia, they gave me 47 because I came in as a fullback. But my story about the Bengals, I get drafted, you know, 17th pick. I fly up to Cincinnati, and the day of the draft that night, and we're doing a press conference, and Coach Lewis has a 99 Bengal jersey. You know, as soon as I walk in, and I was like, hey, Coach, you know, I like 99, but, you know, I was 47. I'd love to be, you know, 47. He was like, no, I like 99. And I was like, well, don't get me wrong. I think 99 is cool too. I would prefer a different number. He was like, no, I had Kirkland in Pittsburgh. It was 99. I think it's going to be perfect. I was like, you know what? 99 is great, Coach. Sounds good.
You know, hey, it means something to you. You know, you get those jerseys, little things like that, little things during your career that you remember that mean things to you. You know what I mean? And it's that make an impact on you. So that's why I was always 36.
Appreciate the story, Dan. Appreciate the time. You guys open up the season hopefully on time on September 5th against Eastern Washington at home. And best of luck on the season. Best of luck, I should say, the rest of the summer, too, and trying to stay safe and healthy.
Thanks. You guys, too. I appreciate everybody. Thanks to everybody out there, all the people that are making sacrifices to keep people healthy. And everybody out there, try to practice our social distancing, learn what we, you know, practice what we've learned so we can get back to normal, get back to some football. So y'all stay safe. Have a great summer and go Gators.
Our next guest here in the College Football Podcast, I've been talking to him for, let's just say, months. Hey, we're going to get you on. We're going to get you on. We're going to get you on. And I'm just so happy that he could finally join us. And that's on my side, not getting him in front of the schedule and making sure he's a priority. Paul Feinbaum joining us here. And Paul, one of the things I've noticed during this crazy time that we live in the offseason of college football is – on your radio show, which is daily, 3 to 6, is that right? 3 to 6?
Close. 3 to 7. But
3 to 7, okay. I go on the air, so I'm not sure when the show ends, but when I listen to it, going into work or when I just have it on while I'm writing, you know, for the show. The one thing that I notice is you have so many guests coming in and sharing their experiences from all parts of the country and talking about, you know, the landscape of college football, the future of college football and the position that people are in. And again, very fluid each and every day. Things adjust. Things are different. What has been your biggest takeaway of the pandemic, the uncertain times when we are seeing player empowerment and, you know, racial inequality and players speaking out against what they've experienced with coaching staffs at universities? What's been your biggest takeaway from these conversations in the last month?
Kevin, it's interesting. I've said the same thing twice, and it's the kind of thing you never really think you're going to say. In the first few weeks of the pandemic, I said, I've never experienced anything quite like this. This is unprecedented, and I can't believe, you know, we're having these conversations. And then a couple of days ago, I said the exact same thing in the aftermath of the George Floyd tragedy, because while they're completely different, they're in many ways equally impactful. About the way we look at things, especially the last couple of days, because, you know, I've spent every day of my life in the South. Even though I was born in the South, my parents and even my older sister are all from New York. So I had kind of that rather unusual upbringing. But in the last few days, just from a caller standpoint, the guttural honesty that I've heard from a lot of people, really coming from different perspectives, has been both difficult, but also heartwarming to experience. And I'm glad because, you know, you for a show, as you know, that spends most of its time arguing over college football, it has been really the most rewarding 3 months of my career.
The most rewarding 3 months of your career? Wow. Is it because you're getting so much emotion? Is it because people are just having truthful conversations?
Yes. From both standpoints, during the early days of the coronavirus, it really felt like the world was coming to an end some nights. I mean, you're going through similar things when you show up and you're looking for the lead story and there's not a sports story within a sports activity within months. Once everything gets canceled, and with our case, I really I found myself going through all kinds of emotions the first couple of weeks. Highs and lows and depression. And I decided, you know, I think we just have to be honest about it. And I was honest. And then we seemed to be making a lot of progress on COVID. And then we had this event that, you know, we watched in shock, and then reactions started coming in. And about 3 days into it, I was trying to find a way that we could have a conversation about it. And at the time, you know, it was still early on. The, you know, athletes had not really said very much other than reaction. And we invited a friend of mine on, who happens to be a CNN analyst whose father was a civil rights leader in South Carolina. And he really broke the door down. And from that moment on, we have not turned back. And everyone that you can think of from college coaches struggling to talk about their feelings about going to a Black Lives Matter protest, to Sylvester Croom being on the other night, who in 2004, Kevin, was the first African American coach in the SEC. And I asked him, you know, how do you think we're doing? He said, not very well. He said, I was the first coach in 2003, and there's still one coach. And he lit in to not only the college game, but in particular the NFL game, where he spent 14 years as an assistant coach, just saying it really was not fair to coaches of color. And it was a startlingly raw, honest conversation.
14 minority coaches right now in the FBS. Do you think with this awareness, especially that conversation with Sylvester, do you think with this awareness things will change when it comes to understanding and, hey, let's hire somebody? Because one of the things in college football, I think, if you look around, that really – kind of gets under my skin is nepotism. And we can see that nepotism in many major programs where, instead of a minority getting an opportunity, it's like, oh, well, my son or I know somebody. And we know this business is if you know somebody in a high recommendation, but we're not seeing any type of development through the ranks where we could see black coaches and black assistants move up and have the ability to grow in positions. Do you think that will change now coming off of this inflection point?
I do. And you said something that you talked about nepotism, and you know, back to Sylvester Croom for a second. One of the angriest I've ever been in my career involved in a coaching search was 2003, Kevin. I was in Alabama. Alabama had hired Mike Price from Washington State. He did not make it out of spring for reasons which we won't even waste time with now. He got fired. And the coaching search came down to two people, Sylvester Croom and Mike Shula. Sylvester Croom went to Alabama, as Shula did. He was one of the first African-American players there. He was the captain of the team. His father was the team chaplain. He had an impeccable reputation. And Alabama decided to go for Mike Shula, who was really inexperienced. He had been a failed coordinator in the NFL. But he got the job because of his father. His father, we just got through celebrating him. He's one of the greatest coaches, if not the greatest in NFL history. But his son was not qualified, but the school just did not want to have to deal with it. What did they not want to have to deal with? The negativity from some about hiring a coach of color. And it just struck me. I'm sitting there thinking, I'm looking at the calendar, and we are 40 years past. We're knocking on the door of the 40-year anniversary of George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, standing in schoolhouse door there, trying to block a young African American student, and the symbolism of this hire would have lifted Alabama up, and instead they hired Shula. He 4 years later he got fired because he was essentially incompetent. And meanwhile, Sylvester Croom goes to Mississippi State and really, I thought was going to be a trailblazer. And of course, I mean, there have been some hires. Kevin Sumlin was at Texas A&M and Derek Mason is coaching at Vanderbilt and Joker Phillips was coaching at Kentucky, but it didn't do what I thought it was going to do. I do think now, this moment in time is too important. You can't just hide behind, I don't want to deal with the negativity. That's no longer an excuse.
You mentioned you can't hide behind it, and the taping of this podcast is, I mentioned it a couple times, is before Iowa has their news conference later on this afternoon with Kirk Ferentz and three other players. And there are rumors on what's going to be discussed. We just know that there's a handful of past players who are African-American. They have spoken out on the culture there and the idea of being treated unfairly and that they can't be themselves. They can't be in their own skin on campus, especially when they're, to me, what blew me away is when you're inside the football facility, when everybody talks about it's a meritocracy and everybody gets along and everybody's treated fairly. Well, Chris Doyle has been put on administrative leave pending a review because they talk about the negative experiences while they were under, Doyle's supervision, many of these black players. When you hear all this stuff and Kirk Ferentz is one of the most popular men in that state, right? Because of what he has done. He is a consistent winner and that program 8 to 10 wins every time, every year and a bowl game. And when you talk about having a culture that's insulated and you're protecting all corners from the outside world and players speaking out, now he has to come clean. Where do you think this is going to lead us as not just this season, but in this cultural shift?
I think this case the Utah case and the Florida State incidents is totally different, by the way, but it's just the winds of change are here, Kevin, and I'm really interested in Iowa because in Kirk Ferentz you have a coach who's always been very quiet. He doesn't show up on our radar screen very often. Maybe he pulls a big upset every once in a while, but I don't know how it's going to end, but he needs to answer for it. And college football coaches, I think, you know, I'll throw the NFL coaches as well, especially the older ones, are the worst. They don't answer to anyone or anybody about anything. And I don't think that works anymore. And even somebody asked me the other day, what do you think? You think Nick Saban will change? He better, because I just don't think you can get away with it anymore. I really don't. And that's how dramatic this is. And, you know, I've studied history and you always, you know, history usually takes a long time, to be written. This history is not taking a long time to be written in this particular moment, because we are watching it in real time. And, you know, coaches who try to deflect and obfuscate and get defensive, and I'm talking about Dabo Swinney there, are going to have a hard time, you know, swimming out of this situation.
All right, let's talk quickly here about Dabo, because you were on SportsCenter with me earlier this week. You've been very critical, and ours, you know, people need to understand, Dabo releases a 14-minute video. We take an excerpt from it because it is TV. You can't play the whole 14 minutes. We take an excerpt of it, and then we hash it out, and we talk about it. And as well as we talked about, you know, the silence that we saw from Dabo in the week prior. What was your reaction now after a couple of days, after hearing the full 14-minute video statement about, you know, Dabo facing criticism for not firing the assistant, Danny Pierman, Dabo also wearing the Football Matters T-shirt? Your reaction as you've had time to think about it. And, you know, also Dabo facing for the first time questions about whether he's a racist, which it was like, wow, we are getting to this point where players have to now speak out and former players have to say Dabo's not a racist. I never thought we'd be in that situation, but this is 2020. And after the last couple of days to process it, what's been your reaction to Dabo's statement and how Dabo's moving forward?
Yeah, Kevin, I felt a little better watching the whole thing, but not much better. And I say that only because, and many have said this already, but he missed the point. This is not about him. And I think Dabo, because he lives in Clemson, which is an insular town, and he has all these walls around him, made a mess out of the situation. And what's interesting about the Clemson case is the university helped him out today by the board voting to take the names of these key figures in Clemson history off the board. Both men. One was a leader in the slavery movement in the Senate, and as well as being vice president in the 1800s. And another one was an avowed racist later. I think that will lessen the criticism and the tension on that campus. Trevor Lawrence coming out defending Dabo, while expected, probably helps in the moment. I think the key moment for Dabo is Saturday night. There's going to be a protest where a number of his players are going to be, and how he handles that. I mean, he has to show empathy and that he really understands, or otherwise, I think come Monday, we're going to be talking about Dabo again. And at some point, if that is the case, and I don't think it will be, but if it is, he is going to start losing this battle very badly. Kevin, it's a small world, the college football fraternity. Dabo is one of the most popular people in the world of college football, media and coaches, and everyone praises his program. But this is a tipping point for him, and he better get it right, or he's going to start suffering off the field.
You're right. You're 100% right. Saturday, and when you say off the field, there's a lot of things, because there was a certain armor that Dabo had, like a bulletproof armor, right, in the college football world when it comes to conversations and how he's covered by the media, and I think also how he's viewed by fans, right? And he's taken some hits lately, and Saturday night he's got to come out, especially for a guy who's as charismatic and as outgoing. There's never a microphone Dabo doesn't like, right? Considering that how he is outspoken on many things, he needs to take control Saturday night in the sense of, hey, I'm aware of what's going on and I understand. And that we didn't see that, it felt like, last week. And hopefully that'll be different. One of the things you were in the news with as well, and you brought his name up a couple times, is Nick Saban. And you mentioned a window getting tighter and tighter for him on his time. Do you want to expand and clarify a little bit more about that? Because again, when you make these comments on a hypothetically like a get up, you have like a, you know, 30 seconds to a minute to say something, and you say it, and then it can get, you kind of lose the narrative after that because it can get interpreted by everybody. What do you want to say about Nick Saban's time here and also that window for him at age 69?
Yeah, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to walk it back. I'm not going to, though. I think it is a narrow window. And, you know, only once since he arrived at Alabama has he gone this long without winning a national championship. And I know somebody out there in the country is going, is this guy out of his mind? And the guy's won six national championships in his career, five at Alabama. But we don't judge Nick Saban on the same curve that we judge Kirk Ferentz or really anyone else. He's the greatest coach in college football history. He's had perhaps the most amazing dynasty. And, you know, if he doesn't win this year, that's 3 years. And I'll repeat what I said the other day. A year from now, Kevin, if we're both able to be having this conversation, I will say, and Nick Saban goes into next season, and when he will turn 70, having not won a national championship in 3 years. And it gets more difficult. I mean, he was racking them up with such a speed and rapidity that you couldn't dare say what I said the other day without catching unmitigated criticism. But I think you can now because, you know, Dabo Sweeney, by the way, is the threat to that crown. He's won two championships. I don't think anyone out there can say that he's not capable of winning a few more with the type of program that he's built. There probably isn't anyone else out there that would have a shot unless Urban Meyer comes out of retirement. He has three titles. So I think Saban is fighting the clock, and I've covered a lot of coaches in their 60s and into their 70s, including Bobby Bowden and Joe Paterno, and it gets more difficult. It doesn't mean, 11-2 was Alabama's record last year. They had a top 10 finish. And Kevin, I considered it a failure. I mean, by Nick Saban's standards, he had one of the best quarterbacks of all time, and he didn't get it done. I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to keep my feet and boots deeper in the mud.
But you're speaking truth here because of Nick Saban's standard. It is on the same level as Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, even Tiger Woods. If they don't win at a certain amount of time, it's not a question of, when are they going to win next? It's what's wrong? How much more can they do? You know, because they've set this standard for themselves in this business where they separate themselves and they're in the greatest of all time conversations. And that's where Nick Saban is. When everybody talks about excellence and expectations, you know, the relief is really on the wins. That's not the happiness. And that's kind of where Nick Saban's world is right now. It's the relief of, hey, did we win? Just so I could breathe a little bit instead of just wondering what's next, what's next, what's next. And for me, the other question that I want to talk to you about, Paul, here is what's next year for college football, especially now, when we look at the Power Five, and that's 65 teams, and then you throw in Notre Dame, and you don't have one singular voice. Does that concern you about the direction of this sport and where it's going right now? And this is not a knock on the Group of Five. I'm just talking about the Power Five, where when they want to make a decision, and they call Notre Dame as well, they all make sure they congregate and they talk about the future of the sport. There is no singular voice. And when we have a pandemic, it stands out here.
Kevin, for most of the last 3 months, because we haven't really had much else substantive to talk about. I mean, I've interviewed pretty much every commissioner and head coaches and athletic directors. And quite frankly, if you put everything they've said into a pot, it makes no sense whatsoever. Because they're all talking from different perspectives. They're all talking from different parts of the country. And I realize the Power Five commissioners talk pretty much every day. And they're running their Zoom bill up. But, you know, what's going to happen, though, when we get to the season and we have a problem at Michigan and the president there who was on the record is saying that he might shut things down if there's an outbreak? And what happens in the West Coast if they don't get off the ground like we all think they are going to? Mark Emmert has nothing really to do with this. He's the president of the NCAA. The NCAA has jurisdiction over rules and regulations, but they don't really control the sport. They're outliers all the time saying we have to have a czar of college football. But it's never been more accurate and it's never been more true, because I really still don't think, as many times as they've met and conversed over these last 3 months, that college football really knows what it's doing as we get closer to a season that, I mean, you've heard it 1,000 times. It's not going to look normal. It's going to be like a roller coaster. Will it finish? How will the testing go? I mean, there's a million questions. And I talked to a father of a player the other day at one of the biggest programs in the country. And I said, how are the voluntary workouts going? He said, it's chaos. Nobody really knows what's going on. And I think that's the problem right now. And we're knocking the door of the season. What do we know?
Yeah. What do we know? Right. And that's a great point. And then what do we know about down the road? If, you know, we get another, another wave here and then we peak again. And then what happens in the middle of the season? What do we do with the rest of the season? That's so many questions and very few answers. And it feels like on a daily basis, things continue to change, and they will, I think, in the coming months. Paul, you're always outstanding. Always love having you on. Actually, it's great to talk to you at length here, outside from our Sports Center hits. And, once again, 3 to 7 PM Eastern time, the Paul Feinbaum Show. I always get the chance to check it out on, channel 81 on Sirius XM. So Paul, thank you.
Kevin, it was such a pleasure to visit. I hope we can do this again. Thank you very, very much.
And that'll wrap things up here on the College Football Podcast. Outstanding stuff there and perspective from Paul Feinbaum. And that's a huge fear down the road, to be honest with you. Where are we going to be and who's going to be when it comes to the leadership, who's going to be stepping up here if we get hit with another wave with the COVID-19? And when you hear the analysts and the experts, they're anticipating something down the road, and hopefully it's going to pass, but we've got to be realistic. So thank you for his opinions, a lot of them. And Paul's great on his radio show for 4 hours. And I love his callers because they're passionate. And for him to weave through with guests, he always does an outstanding job. A big thanks as well to Dan Mullen, Florida head coach, for his perspective on a lot of things. It's also great to hear him talk about his time when he played from quarterback to tight end and switching around. Taylor Schwenk on the other side, thank you. He's coordinating all these podcasts to come through smoothly, whether it's through FaceTime, Zoom, or Pollock going through a Chick-fil-A in the middle of an interview. Only Pollock can do something like that, as well as going through Skype. So, Taylor, thank you. And as promised, we will continue to bring you college coaches as well as reporters during the summertime, because there's such a fluid situation where teams are coming back and how are they handling things in their own way, because there is no one specific way. We're seeing at each university that as we continue to learn how they handle positive tests, or also how they're preparing for potentially positive tests down the road. So we want to make sure that you guys are all safe and healthy. And until the next time we talk, just enjoy the days, because I'm just grateful it's summertime. And as a guy that's at home with his kids as well while working, I'm just grateful this is the last day of school. Thank goodness. And a big thank you to our teachers and anybody that does homeschooling full time. Take care and be well.